pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, Pat.
Shute.
Here.
Ellwanger.
Here.
Grundike.
Here.
McNaughton.
Here.
Needhammer. Newton.
Here.
Place.
Here.
Ross.
Here.
I'd just like to welcome Monica to the Planning Commission.
Thank you. It's so exciting to be here.
And unfortunately, Joe St. John has called me this afternoon and indicated that he's resigning. His wife's going through some health issues and she wants to spend more time with her. He has served over 29 years for our planning commission.
Wow. Yeah. So,
publicly say that we really appreciate his contributions.
Absolutely. And then he said, Tom.
Tom will be a little late. He was on the bridge at 4 o'clock.
Okay. All right. So do we need to excuse his lateness? Tardiness?
No, usually it's just an absence.
All right, let's move on to the consent agenda. Approval minutes for August 19, 2019.
We approve the consent agenda and minutes, sorry.
Okay, I have a motion. Is there a second?
How many motion?
A second.
A motion and a second. Motion and a second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Move on to 4. Hearing citizens present on non-agenda items. Okay. Move on to 5. Reports of officers, board, standing committees.
None.
None. Unfinished business. None. Move on to new business. A. Proposed zoning ordinance amendments to reduce housing barriers.
Now this may look familiar as we look at this back in June. Not everybody was here. I know Jeff, you weren't here, and you raised some concerns about some of them. So, and Monica obviously wasn't here. So, I thought I'd bring this back just for some more discussion to make sure that anything that we move forward for is a consensus of the group.
Okay.
So, basically, what this was doing was in response to the task given to the city by the city commission to look at the ordinance and see where there are any opportunities to reduce the housing barriers. And so this part, these proposed amendments were developed with that mind frame. Some of the amendments were to the definition section. That was just mostly cleaning up language and getting redundancies out. No real big substantive changes there. Where some of the changes start getting substantive would be in Article 4, that's the traditional residential district, and that's where we're looking at allowing attached or detached accessory units, accessory dwellings, which basically is another dwelling allowed on a property where a primary dwelling is and it's owner-occupied. And also making two-family dwellings as a use by right. So those are pretty significant changes. Those were special use permits before. And then in the special use in that district, we looked at putting multiple family dwelling units up to 4 units as a special use. So those are the changes in that district. So I know, Jeff, you talked about the multiple families and concerns there.
Yeah, I honestly, is this open for discussion?
Yeah,
this is open. Okay, my biggest concern, the two-family dwellings actually doesn't bother me. The four-family, you clarified that, and made perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
I still personally feel it's a little weird to, as a right-by use, let somebody just put an apartment on in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
I did see it. There's actually a setback requirement. I didn't realize. I must have missed that in the first draft.
Yeah, 10-foot.
Yeah, so it's not like the plumbing requirement on the property line. Kind of
right.
But out of all the amendments in this section, that was the only one that was kind of a little wishy-washy to me. I mean, as a property owner, I'm not sure I would be comfortable with my neighbor being able just to randomly put an apartment in the backyard without having some kind of public input. about it, but if, you know, the consensus of the rest of the board is that you all agree that you don't see any issues with that, then I'm not saying I should go along with it.
That would be subject to accessory building setbacks, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, it'd still have to fit within the ordinance, but they wouldn't have to come in front of us to have
well,
it.
A detached accessory dwelling unit would have a larger setback than just an accessory structure, detached accessory structure. Those are allowed up to 3 feet of the rear side lot line. If you wanted to do an accessory dwelling unit detached, it's going to have to be 10 feet off your lot line.
Right.
Okay, so it really has to do with the density. As we've all been talking about, that the density on the lot, if it's already filled with one house, it's going to be very difficult to put a whole another apartment building on there.
Well, that's where you can be attached or detached. You can be part of the primary dwelling if you want it. It's a special amount of space. And,
right.
That.
So that would be more duplex.
Well, the difference is it has to be owner occupied. So the primary dwelling would have to be owned by the person living there.
Okay.
Duplex, that's not the case.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. What's the minimum square footage of an apartment, Scott?
A minimum square footage of a dwelling
right.
is 674 square feet.
So that would hold true. In other words, they would still have to maintain the ordinance if they plan on making it an apartment.
No.
No.
There's no minimum size for accessory dwelling.
Oh,
okay. That minimum is just set for new construction.
Right, a primary dwelling would have that minimum square footage, but you know, you could finish off a smaller space in your home and have that be accessory.
Interesting. And what about detached, however? What if it's not an attached part of it?
Same.
No, so they can like, basically like convert into a bedroom and say they're going to use the indoor facilities?
Well, lots of people do. Accessory dwelling, or not accessory dwelling, but finished space.
Right.
Like above a garage.
Well, that. Sure.
Yeah, that's not a dwelling.
Right.
You know, but if it is contains bedroom, bathroom, kitchen,
right.
then that's, by definition, a dwelling. And there is no minimum space for that.
Right.
So they could do the same thing for the small kitchenette, like bathroom, above a garage, and they use that as an accessory unit.
So basically the way the ordinance is written now, say they did have a loft area above a garage, they were converted to an apartment, they would have to come in front of the board to do
no,
so.
This would change that to make it administrative.
Right. Currently, they do
currently,
have to come
they have to come and get a special
this would give them, basically, by right,
yes.
the ability to do that.
Absolutely.
See, for me, that's less of an impact to the neighbors as, per se, the detached accessory building. So that's genuine, sure only concern with that revision, guys. So I don't know how everybody else feels about that.
Yeah. Well, when we were talking about finding some of these barriers, mm-hmm. you would talk about the way to increase housing is through density. Mm-hmm. What were the other suggestions? It was
well, cost is one of the biggest.
Cost.
You can reduce lot size. You can reduce building size. Those can reduce those size, increase density,
exactly.
get more value out of a piece of land.
Right, so but by giving this as an option for more housing, makes the cost less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, you create more units.
And
that's the theory.
Yeah.
In reality, how many people create accessory dwelling units? I see a limited number, but maybe that special use permit process is a barrier. So,
and you had said that there are a few that we might not know about that are accessory buildings that are being used as dwellings.
Well, yeah, because there's also tax implications.
Sure, for development.
If someone develops an accessory dwelling unit, then that they no longer get a homestead on the entire piece of property and they're prorated and those kinds of things. So they may be reluctant to go through a permit process that would, identify where these would be.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have any problem with this. I think it's an easy solution, and then Scott also mentioned before, I believe, that you haven't had that many applications for accessory
right.
buildings.
Right. Maybe a half dozen.
Okay.
Okay, question on how it is presented. Right now, you've got in the Article 4, it starts out with single family attached dwellings. A. B is public parochial and private schools. C is municipal parks and playgrounds. And then chunk down to E is home occupations in which customers or patrons do not visit the site. So
that's the existing ordinance that we're talking about.
The existing ordinance. Yeah. So what happens to public parochial, municipal
Those would all be renumbered and reformatted. And they would, the only changes are language that's being shown to you. I didn't put the entire article through there just to conserve space.
All right, I will note a typo under C on this proposal. Home occupations in which customers or patrons do not visit the site as opposed to visit the site. That's how it is written here.
Okay, I'll take a look at that. Not that I didn't change anything there.
So yeah, okay, so it's not in italics, right? And it's not crossed out, so I just didn't know about that.
Sure. And there's lots of typos in this ordinance because it was done in the previous version of Word. And then when it's converted, like you'll find like an apostrophe where you know there was an S or something. It's crazy. Yeah, if you find those, we'll bring them to my attention.
We can fix them.
Okay, now, do we see any concern about architecture, size and architecture issues, that type of thing?
Well,
that we don't want something that's all of a sudden, literally, the house, large barn.
Well, there's already, you know, minimum size or maximum size standards for the dwelling. And then there's design guidelines in the ordinance that apply to the various districts. And there is actually some discretion that the planning department has in reviewing structures to make sure they're in character with the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a tough thing to decide what's character, but there is some flexibility.
But the design guidelines also talk about space as well.
Oh. Yeah. And, you know, how the houses line up on the street and other things. And mm-hmm. There's things in the ordinance that require
that. Okay. Right. But the accessory buildings, do they still have to apply the same type of roof line and things like that? Or is that?
Yeah, those standards, you know, the minimum pitch and those things. And
oh, sure.
It has to be, you know, consistent with the architecture. So, you know, can't put basically
my shed looks like a part of the house.
would a public hearing be required for this ordinance change?
Yeah, any ordinance change. The process is once this commission is comfortable with the language, a public hearing is set to hear, you know, at the planning commission. And then after that public hearing is held, it goes to the city commission. And then it has to go to first and second reading. So then, you know, the second reading can't happen no less than a month prior to the first reading, so you got time in that.
So at this point, right now, this is only addressing the traditional residential district. Any thought of including it in the waterfront residential as well as the rural?
Well, that was a discussion we had. And there was basically a consensus of the commission at the time that no, not to include accessory dwellings as part of the waterfront residential.
Oh, no, okay.
I had made mention at that time, and one of my thoughts, Paul, I was still very fresh on the commission, was that, you know, with the waterfront there, being able to have the ADUs in sight is going to, I think, ultimately change our waterfront views.
Right.
When you're adding density in, you know, in an area where the waterfront's going to be ultimately changed. And, you know, I kind of thought that the idea was that that would ultimately alter, I think, the kind of intrinsic character of one city along the waterfront. So I was very, very loud against that.
Okay. but the other thing was is to look at the different districts as to where we could apply density and not have it be impactful to everybody else. So.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, obviously the waterfront, the people try and pay for the views.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, and that becomes, what about the rural estate? And I thought of the rural estate.
I thought that was part of it.
Maybe I'm missing it if it's really down.
Just further on, we talk about the CBD. And,
yeah, I don't think we included any changes for the rural estate, but if that's something that you want, you know.
Because the rural estate is far less dense than traditional residential.
Yeah, it's basically the lots are twice the size as the traditional residential district. Typically, you don't have water and sewer availability. So if you want, I can put similar language for accessory dwelling units in the rural estate. You let me know.
Would that have implications on standalone septic and well for the units then? I mean,
yeah, they would have to size them. If you're going to add bedrooms and whatnot, they're going to have to size those fields accordingly.
And you'll have to get approval from the health department.
Yeah.
Correct,
right?
Okay.
Does anyone, I mean, I think we're kind of talking about adding that as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Article 7, manufactured housing development district, changed a lot of terminology to change how we speak about these developments as opposed to mobile homes, the manufactured
housing. Rather than a mobile home park, it's a manufactured housing development district.
Yeah, and you know, I basically, when you look at the principal permitted uses, it said manufactured housing units. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't talk anything about developments, you know, that's kind of the whole point of this district is to allow these developments, not just units. But these units can go anywhere, you know, as long as they meet minimum size requirements. You know, we can't dictate construction. So if someone has a mobile home and it meets our minimum standards for the traditional residential district, you'd have to allow it to go there. So that's just a correction in how this is looking at it. Then really the only substantive change is would be the allowance or the 10 units per acre. As opposed to looking at that minimum lot size of 5,500 square feet, which is more than a traditional residential district. So it really doesn't make sense if you're looking at a unit to create density to have, you know, lot size bigger than what your residential district is. So, just looking at 10 units per acre, that is the same as the multifamily district. And looking at the existing development there, that's kind of what they got going right now. When you look at those lot sizes, and that's about what they're working on, so it seems to work. So that's changing the debate there. And then the other change was on the open space requirements. You know, the state act specifically says if you have over 50 sites, 2% or 25,000 square feet needs to be open space. And then our ordinance has a further caveat that 10,000 square feet of that needs to be active in open space, but doesn't affirm you can define what active is. So,
right.
But you can guess. So I would eliminate that. The state act also has something where they can waive that 25,000 completely if you have optional improvements. It doesn't define what an optional improvement is. So I don't know what, you know, is that having a, you know,
RX
like a community room or something like that? So I don't know. But so I think if we go back just to the blanket 25,000 square feet, if they have that much open space within the development, then that would meet our ordinance requirements.
Well, we waive the 10,000 square foot on the
right, and you know, that was an existing park.
Right.
So it was really kind of amendment to an existing plan, and so it wasn't there. So it, to me, to put that burden on after the fact, and it was a, you know, a little burdensome for the town.
Is that the only manufactured housing district that we have in Woodson?
Yes, it is. Okay. So that may be something that, when you look at the future land use map, you know, are there other areas that you would think that would be, you know, the development of that kind of thing?
And that would be a part of the master plan, or
what's that?
That could be part of the master planning.
Yeah, you could designate that area. You know, it's kind of chicken and the egg kind of thing to me. You know, if you don't have any developers, and you may have some other preferred uses for a piece of land as opposed to manufactured housing development, and so you zone it for that, and then no one comes along and does it. So,
right.
But I would identify an area that could be, and then if a development comes, then you say, yeah, this is property that could be resolved with that. All right. Then in the central business district, we looked at the apartment buildings up to 8 units. Here it has, you know, setback requirements for developing those, which when you're looking at the central business district, you kind of want that density and mass, and you want buildings up the street, you know, and if you build buildings that don't meet that, you know, setting, and then they're repurposed to something else, they're kind of out of, you know, out of place. So in my mind, you know, it's back to the whole form-based zoning thing, where you're more concerned with what the building looked like as opposed to what exactly going on in the building. Because if, you know, the building is going to be there 100 years, it could transition to 10 different users. So, but as long as the building's, you know, quality built in a way, in the place you want it, you know, it doesn't matter. So,
is that the reason behind the going from a one bedroom to more studio efficiency apartment allowable?
Yes.
Nice. Central business district, apartment buildings at 8 per unit building, a lot. As long as public utilities are available and all the units shall have at least one living room, one bedroom, that's being strictly out.
Right.
Or is that just restating something that's in multifamily?
Well, I guess I would dictate how many types of units they have. I mean, let the market dictate that.
Okay. Yeah, that was more of a form-based.
Yeah.
So, and then also, like you were saying, that if it's a commercial property, it's zero lot line.
Right.
But if it was a residential, it would.
Then you have the setback, and then also you have this, you know, you have
a house.
The master plan has a vision for the central business district. You know, it wants taller buildings, it wants flat roofs, it wants things up the street. Then you kind of put this ordinance in here, and that defeats exactly what you're trying to achieve with the master plan. So it seems to me it's counterproductive. And the central business district and the transitional commercial district had similar language. So those changes were kind of brought through both of those different districts.
All right, but, and then the other thing was on to M.
The mixed use?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would, where, you know, like Ross and Lake Street, you know, that would give them the opportunity for mixed use development to have those ground floor units, given that, you know, those are situated in such a way that they still have commercial availability in the front, and you can access those in the back, or in the entrance section.
So yeah, basically there's no access to the residential from the storefront.
Right. So it kind of reserves that space for them.
It's almost the concept of that smaller retail up front, living space on the ground level behind, which could,
you know, and that space behind, you know, that's access from the parking lot or whatever, it's kind of hidden from the street.
Right.
You know, it has limited commercial value, you know,
right,
storage or whatnot. So you can probably, you know, when we're looking for housing, better utilize that for, you know, this kind of unit. those were the really big changes, and you know, if you want, I can bring it back with the rural state district changes. I would assume they would mimic what is proposed as a traditional residential district in regards to the use by right for accessory dwelling units and duplexes, or just accessory dwelling units, and I guess let me know.
Yeah, I think accessory dwelling units and duplexes, I mean, we might as well have it go the same across the board with all of them.
Yeah.
Especially if we're talking about an area that could use more density.
Yeah. And then the multifamily as a special use in that district, it might be not quite as in character as it is by the traditional residential districts, so we may not want to do that.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah, agreed.
Okay. With that, I can set up a public hearing for next month if you want to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I do have one question, guys. I'm just curious why apartments are limited to 8 units, but mixed use, there's no limitation there on apartments. I'm just curious how the ordinance came about.
Well, I was just carrying the existing forward.
Right.
So,
right.
If you want to.
No, I'm just curious why that limitation's there for.
I'm not sure why it was established that way.
Right.
Because it is something that I thought about too.
Right. Why there's a limitation to one but not the other.
Perhaps, you just want to make sure. There was area reserved for commercial, or
right.
Want.
Right. So if you're doing a dedicated apartment, you're just limiting how much?
You want to make sure some of that space is saved for commercial.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
And that's to keep the front of the buildings pattern like all right. Any questions about this?
No.
Okay. Scott, yeah, set that up for
October,
please.
We'll do.
Thank you. All right, let's move on to proposed zoning ordinance amendments for parking requirements.
I gave you an updated report from Annika Lawrence, who did our parking review. This was the last task that she had to look at our ordinance. It basically just showed some ranges of costs of parking spaces and various communities, kind of give us an idea of what the typical rate is. But basically, she suggested two different things to look at our ordinance. And one was to take those parking generation ratios and use those to determine required parking in the downtown corridor. At our previous discussion, we looked at the downtown core area as the central business district and also the transitional commercial district, which basically is all downtown, and then kind of the transitional runs up Lake Street here all the way up to Volvo. So that area there would be part of the downtown core. And what these parking generation ratios are is there are less amount of parking required for a variety of uses, and those were identified in that. So you're probably looking at probably 30-40% reduction overall with those years. And when we look at why this is, the central business district and the core is much different, just because of the availability of public parking, the walkability, the people from the residential areas can walk to the downtown, limiting the need for parking. So you have a much lesser demand for parking. So with that in mind, you want to reduce those amounts because you don't want to develop parking that's not needed, which can be used for other purposes. So this would basically be integrated into the existing section with the development of a new article, our section 2045. And there I just took in those basic ratios and put them into there. And so this is the first stab at it, so let me know. I think it's all right. And then the other suggestion was to implement a fee that someone could pay if they can't develop the minimum amount of parking, and then they could buy those spots. It'll be a one-time fee. So once they pay it, that use is good for as long as the duration that use is, they could change ownership or whatever and still be. What would change is if the use changed and it did, increased the demand even more, they could apply and pay the difference if they did that change. So that is changes in the beginning of the article. Under section 2420, off-street parking, where there was an idea of having a parking exempt district and development of this map, which was done at one time and then it was repealed because of referendum. And then the city commission never established a fee because we didn't have the district. So, this article to change is specifically designate the downtown core as the transitional commercial district and the central business district and allow that payment of that fee for those in that district. And then the amount, that would be subject to the city commission and it would be part of the fee schedule, the annual budget. So that's something that they look at annually and then every time it changes, you don't have to come into court.
To clarify on that, Scott, you said that's section 2420, and does that have its own letter there?
Yes. It should be on the first page of the article 24 parking zoning near the bottom here, 2420. So that seemed to be the simplest way to integrate that concept into this. The concept is there, but it's kind of different than the guide, so I just...
Right, but the concept would
make it work.
The majority of it was already actually in ordinance, but we just didn't identify what the district was.
Right, where so this kind of identifies that right. District, and then allow the city commission to adopt that fee, and then that's going to be something that's a discretionary determination. Basically, someone would have to request to do that, and then the planning commission could determine whether or not they would allow that. And so you could say yes, we'll pay them, or no, we need parking. So you have complete control over that. They just can't pay it to be done. You have still a power.
Mm-hmm. How do you come up with a number?
Well, that's the trick, and that's why I asked.
I read that exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So, Annika said for this area, that's probably a pretty good number. But we probably want to talk at staff level and see what we spend on maintenance, what do we call what's the cost to develop the space, and depreciate that over time and those kinds of things, and then come up with a fair number that. Still have to have the rate someone's going to pay.
Yeah.
If you put it too high, exactly. It's 95 points. So.
Well, I looked at some of those numbers, it looks like they were kind of asking for a little much.
Oh, yeah, but you got Plymouth, Morville, Rochester, the economics are very different there than they are here.
Yeah. Let's just say land is very expensive in Plymouth and Morville. And that's the thing that I think the land acquisition costs need to be included as opposed to the construction costs.
Right, and that's part of the city commission's discussion about how we identify what a good number is. So with that, I spoke with the Main Street board about this issue. I was invited to T Boyne on Friday to talk with them. I know we want to have a little more discussion on this topic, so I don't think we're ready for a public hearing yet. And I do know we want to have some ability to get some input, so perhaps another month or so we'll see if we can generate some more interest and have some folks participate.
Is there any way to ask those boards if they would come on those? I mean, just to be here in the audience would be part of the discussion.
Yeah. We did have an article in the paper about the
I do find it interesting. I'm looking at this table age that was in the previous month from the report.
Right.
And you know, you come up with some interesting ratios, and you know, depending on whether they're higher or lower than the existing standard, most of them are pretty darn close. I don't see a lot of decrease here, especially for the mixed use.
This is the lower than we have existing.
There is some differences, but it's
well, I mean
it's not 100%. It's not that drastic. Retail,
but
one for every 250, that is 1.65 spaces per 1,000.
So that's like a 40% reduction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then residential, one space per unit.
Where reduction.
What was that?
That's a 50%.
That's a 50% reduction because it was two spaces per unit.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And these generation ratios come from observations of real instances where they've done studies before. So they're probably pretty good numbers, pretty reflective of the downtown dynamic and parking. And so, you know, I kind of trust them to, because the parking numbers that are in the ordinance right now, you know, I'm not sure where those came from. You know, a lot of people look at what does Joe do at their city and they just bring them over without. And there's real limited information on parking generation models. There's the, you know, the Institute of Parking Generation Ratio, whatever, but it's the engineering model that they use. And those are sometimes done in one observation of one user. And then they look at what is like the worst day, and then they develop, you know, parking to meet that need when they actually. In that case, on that worst day, you know, we need to have parking for Christmas year-round.
Right.
Really, so.
Right. And, this is just for the central business district?
Yes.
Transitional?
Yeah, and it takes those values, it looks at them and lowers them from what's typically demanded because you have all those other aspects. And it should be noted that the Planning Commission still has a large degree of discretion. Because in the central business district and the transitional commercial district, you can consider waiving and reducing parking in addition to these, if you want. I mean, that tool is still there.
Right. But the hope is that this will make that happen less.
Right. Well, I think what the hope is, they get these more aligned with reality.
Okay.
Because what was seen to be happening is that a number was developed based on the ordinance. And someone, well, I got to waive 30 parking spaces, when in reality, you really didn't need them. But the perception is, my God, you're waiving 30 parking spaces.
Right, well, right.
In reality, you didn't need them.
Particularly the public.
So this will hopefully reduce that, so where you don't have to use that tool. And if you do, it'd be a much less extent. Okay.
You know, as the density of the downtown development increases, may need to be modified.
Right. Well, as development trends change, I mean, there's talk about the whole way we think about parking now is going to change in 30 years. The development of, you know, driverless cars and Uber and all these things, and you know, kids aren't getting licenses like they did in the past. So, you know, the driver's license is no longer a rite of passage. It's kind of a discretionary choice. The kids are choosing not to do it. They're finding other ways to get around it. So, you know, the parking demand that we've seen, you know, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, is not going to be the parking demand that we see in the future.
Oh, my whole point is if we do get a higher density,
mm-hmm.
there may be a higher demand for parking. If it, I mean,
changed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is this appears to be very good for now.
Yeah. You know, like, you know, the car ownership is going down, and, you know, I think the typical two-car household is going to be, you know, one-car household anymore, rightfully, in the future. So I think these numbers are going to kind of reflect that trend.
And so this wouldn't be coming before us?
Not a public hearing yet. I think we want to do this in its own kind of day, as opposed to intermixing with some other public hearings.
November, December?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And would we have two public hearings?
No, just one required public hearing. You can have as many as you want, but only one required.
Depending on the outcome of the first one.
Well, unfortunately, you know, it seems that it takes some kind of issue to bring people out, as opposed to just being interested in the topic.
Right. So hopefully we can get more people involved with more, not just involved, but knowledge, so that they don't, it isn't enough for.
Yeah, and that's the challenge, to get that education out there.
So you ran this by the Main Street and DDA?
Well, Main Street and DDA are one and the same.
Okay.
It's the Main Street Board. I'm going to talk to the team Boeing on Friday, and that's the kind of group of the city leaders of all various aspects that meet. I talk to them and get feedback on there, and then see if I can find some other groups that, you know, talk to.
I mean, I think people just would have to get used to going around the block occasionally, which is not a big deal.
No. Park a block away.
Yeah.
I noticed this year significantly, like at Point Thunder and some of the other bigger events we did, just having some of the off-site parking that they did with shuttle service in a town seemed to make a huge difference for the impact it made on the people. Like, you know, I live over the south end of Park Street.
So people park all the way up here.
I mean, there would be people parked past my house. Mm-hmm. And all the way down to Elizabeth, and I did not see that same. I mean, there were still the same amount of people here, but I think, you know, those groups working together, those services set up so people could park out there on the outskirts of town and just shuttle in or walk in or whatever they wanted to do.
Maybe that's one of the things identified in the parking study, is to, you know, to address those peaks.
Right.
And those events, and identify good techniques to kind of take care of those, you know, singular issues, and then also, you know, look at, you know, long term. Mm-hmm.
Did anyone else have any questions or suggestions for Scott?
No, he's got some pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's move forward. Let's go on to the proposed stormwater control ordinance.
I kind of gave you a fact sheet that was developed by the Watershed Council, and Bonetta over there. Kind of goes through the history of stormwater ordinance. Basically, the county had one. There's attorney general opinions that the county can't have one, so they got rid of it. And then basically all the municipalities were asked to adopt their own and then enter into agreement with the county to administer and enforce. So they developed an ordinance. The cities were reluctant to adopt that one because it seemed more in tune with the features of a rural township as opposed to a developed city where we have stormwater systems and other things. So we didn't adopt it at that time. So with the increased development pressure, Tip and Mitt kind of came back to us and said, where are you at? Let's kind of look at something. So with the help of them, and we kind of been working with the three cities amongst us to kind of develop one that kind of more fit the needs of the cities. And as the Boeing City received the SAW grant, we can charge a lot of the cost for development and adoption and publication of the ordinance to that grant. So we're kind of taking the lead on this for the others, and we're going to probably meet tomorrow or Wednesday, kind of go through our calendars to make sure we all we did approach the county and provided them with this changed ordinance It's basically, it was modeled after that township ordinance and with some modifications. And they reviewed it and said that was fine. They sent it off to their attorney, Brian Graham, to do a legal review of it. Renetta at Tippin Met reviewed it and said she's fine with it and supports the adoption of it. So with that, we're bringing it to the Planning Commission for review and comment. And any thoughts about it, then we can move those on to the City Commission when they consider it. Okay.
One of the things in there was having an agent, a person that's responsible for it.
Right,
right now, it's someone at the Charlotte County.
Yeah, the city would have the ability to designate the agent. And right now, we would probably enter into an intergovernmental agreement with the county to administer the force. But you know, if we're not pleased with that arrangement, we can point somebody else and do it ourselves.
Right, so the ordinance keeps it open for us to do that.
Yes, yes, we have that flexibility.
In looking through this, it almost looks like the most of this is administration.
Yeah.
The actual design standards are back in Appendix A.
Right.
Yeah. Which I read through, I didn't fully understand.
Well, yeah, that's... and many of these appear to be great for rural state district, but we have a developed city that we have already a stormwater system in place
right.
that residences hook up to or is in the street.
Right, and that's...
About the only thing that would apply to us is sites that are located near the service of the municipal storm system. Has to have a separator system, and it's like mm-hmm. that just seems like a barrier to development in the city, and nothing else has a separator.
All right, and I think water quality from the city commission was a priority, so I think this goes to the lake. I would encourage the separator system.
Okay.
And make that a requirement of, you know, because we're looking at mostly commercial development.
Okay.
You know, residential development really doesn't fall under this unless it's like a big development.
Okay, so then, all right. So, but if somebody wants to redevelop a building and a change of use, do they have to add this?
No. It depends on how much impervious surface they're adding.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Like the Lawson Lake Street and the Roberts across the street, mm-hmm. they wouldn't have to abide by this ordinance because they already were covered completely with impervious surface, so they weren't adding anything. Okay. But they both integrated, stormwater systems into there to take care of that. But so that's probably going to be a situation a lot in redevelopment. Most of the cities, places downtown, is they're already covered with impervious surface.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I can understand the desire to keep unwanted sediment out,
yeah.
especially chemicals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's like, in Sunset Park, the city put a big system in, like 2010 or so, mm-hmm. and then Mr. Cap, paid to connect to that for his stormwater. So, that's what this ordinance does. It allows that flexibility where the system, the city can say, you could pick through our system, and then maybe charge them for the cost of those upgrades or whatever. So instead of the previous ordinance basically limited the amount of acreage where you could designate that. I think it's anything over 3/4 of an acre, and you had to have on-site retention, which in a city doesn't work. You need to have that connection, that storm system. And then this allows us to we'll design it and let you connect to it and reduce cost.
I think you're right on, Scott, that most people don't realize that when they clean the filter out behind the old chamber building, they took dump trucks full of garbage out of there. And that's a great thing. That means the system's working. We have one discharge down by the city beach. Doesn't that go 200 feet out of the water before it takes its... You don't see it, correct?
That's
down in that area, that neighborhood, or not?
I think there's one. There is the sanitary discharge from...
Maybe that's where...
Yeah, that one goes way out.
And then there's, we made some changes to the one up here in North Point. I mean, but everything, Point's a valley, so everything's coming down, and anything that we can do to keep the quality is good. I see, tell them about the changes we did on Cedar, the new construction on Cedar Street and Terrace Street right now. You're almost doing a French drain before it hits the stormwater.
Yeah, so that first flush is kind of filtered, and that's when most sediments come. That's definitely a new feature that we've looked at in regards to street development.
So I apologize, and that definitely not involved in some of the earlier work. So the city, within the existing storm system, has a sedimentation tank, or multiple?
Sunset Park.
Okay.
That's why there really can't be any development in Sunset Park, because underneath is a complete...
Yeah, and that's why it drives DPW director mad when they're out there pounding tent stakes or putting those bills things out there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, now, what is the tank that is underneath the park by Harbridge Marina?
That's the sanitary? Oh, yeah, that's the old wastewater treatment plant.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's where the whole plant was before they relocated over there.
Okay.
I just wanted to make comment that I think the ordinance presented here is really proactive work, certainly with the context given beforehand. I think it's our job as community representatives to support anything we can for ordinances towards the integrity of our waters. That's our responsibility, as it's one of our greatest assets, if not the greatest asset.
Yeah, and that was recognized in the goal setting session and particularly by the city commission, that makes you think of priority.
Did you see I read an article where students at Ann Arbor, engineering students, created basically a monitor at every drainage in the city, and they can monitor by a computer which systems are being overtaxed during a rainstorm, and they can monitor how it's being drained and really take the burden off of their stormwater system. That's going to be the future. It's all done by computers.
Right, yeah, and hopefully we can gather some really good information from the SAW grant regarding to our assets, as part of the study. They did inventory, our system, and they did televise a bunch of it. So we'll have that ability to look at, what's forming, what's performing, what's not, what needs maintenance, that kind of thing.
That's what they did last year, right?
Yeah, with the structural around. Yep. So we haven't got that data yet, but hopefully we'll get that pretty soon.
This is something that we're coming from. There's no action that we need to...
No. If you want to make a recommendation to the city commission in regards to this, I'm sure they appreciate that. But there's no formal action that you need to take. It's just a police power ordinance. We'll go to the city commission for their consideration and adoption.
And we can make that recommendation this evening?
Yeah. Yes.
All right. Yeah, I would make a motion to recommend that our proposed stormwater control ordinance be passed on to the city of Arch.
I've got a motion.
Favorable proposal.
Sorry,
go ahead. You're good. You had it.
I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Skyrim seconds. Motion and a second. Roll call, Pat.
Newton?
Yep.
Place?
Yes.
Ross?
Aye.
Shoup?
Aye.
Ellwanger?
Yes.
Krundeck?
Aye.
McNaughton?
Yes.
Needhammer?
Yes.
Motion carries.
All right. We're going to move on to the staff report.
Reminder that September 30th is the Planning Commission training up in Petoskey at 5 to 8. I did reserve a spot, and I think Monica was interested in going. She goes that. And I also believe Patrick reserved a spot, so if there's someone else that didn't sign up, there's another spot available. So I encourage everyone to go at 8 p.m. It's probably a good focus meeting, and I think it'll be very helpful. The trail pre-construction meeting was held, and it looks like they're going to start probably the 23rd of this month. And it looks like they're going to be probably starting in the village of Boyne Falls, just limited clearing out there, and then kind of staging throughout, kind of leapfrogging to clear the trail and hopefully get it mostly cleared and graded this fall, and then the paving and next year. They also have to build a portion of the boardwalk around the south end of the Boyne Mountain Airport. So they have to build that, so they'll probably be building that through the, hopefully this fall on there. So, that's exciting stuff. I've been working on that for, well, it's one of the first things that I was told my first day here. 16 years ago.
I see the parking lot on Dam Road. They got the sidewalk all taped out, and they got the restroom there.
Yeah, that was a different grant that they were able to have to get that restroom facility and those improvements done, so they're moving forward with that.
They graveling? Is that going to be asphalt, or is that going to be blacktop?
It's going to be asphalt. The entire trail is going to be asphalt.
Well, yeah. But, yeah,
the, and the parking lot.
Okay. Good. That's very cool.
Well, at the last I heard, you know, projects changed.
All right. Good of the order.
Okay, I've got a question. What's the status of the short-term rental ordinance?
There is no short-term rental ordinance.
I understand, but is there one going to be formed?
The city commission charged us with the duty of identifying the impact of short-term rentals. I'm still not sure what those are. I have done an inventory in the city. There's probably about 100 of them. The lion's share are probably, you know, like Water Street Inn, the Harbridge, you know, the Landings, you know, these that have been typically used for these rental units.
Right.
For many, many years. And probably last 5 years or so, there's been something of a conversion of residential units in the traditional residential district. I found probably about 30 to 40 of those. Probably a third of those are homestead, so it's somebody who lives there that's renting out a room when they leave or have an accessory unit, that kind of thing. So we have probably in a given time, probably about maybe 25 or 30 houses that are displaced for short-term rentals. Yeah. So is that a good or bad thing? I still don't know. You know, you have to look at what's the economic impact of these units and these folks as they come in, the town spend money and that kind of thing. And then okay, to displace them here, where do they go? So, you know, if an ordinance is developed, you know, I think the only real focus would be to limit that displacement of the housing units. I have received very limited complaints.
Can I say one thing on that?
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Just as far as a complaint on that, it makes it for families like myself trying to buy houses in Boyne City very hard.
There is no doubt that it does increase rental costs.
I mean, it's just trying to.
But whether or not that can be singularly attributed to seasonal rentals, I don't know. I mean, those prices are going to go up regardless. So maybe, you know, 5% increase due to that, maybe. You know, there's some studies out there that have that number. So, but there is an association that does make it more costly. And the other thing is, you know, the city has events throughout the summer, pretty much every weekend. have one hotel in town with 12 rooms. So we're inviting all these folks to town, but providing a place for them to stay. So that's the other side. Okay, is that something we want to encourage or do it in a different way? So I don't know. So the impact, back to the question. An ordinance isn't being developed yet. We're still looking at what the impact is. And then once you identify that, okay, what are you trying to regulate?
No, what I mean, the way I see it is, yes, we have an influx of people, but as Scott was talking about, you're taking houses off the market that should be part-time, full-time residences that would, in my mind, far more benefit the city than some rentals. Now the other thing is, I thought the intent, we really wanted a hotel. You know, there was some discussion that the city really needs a hotel. Now we're discouraging that because short-term rentals will take over. And we've got the Dilworth now that's going to be opening up.
Yeah.
That needs to be supported. So, you know, I so far Spring Lake has been able to pass an ordinance.
Yeah, lots of communities have.
Yeah, lots of communities have. And it's one of these things I wouldn't want. I mean, I've already heard somebody outside the city limits though talk about that there's two or three of them right around them, right on the waterfront. And he says, didn't buy my house to be in a commercial district with a hotel next to me. So, I would just, personally, I would encourage it. Kind of limit locations as well as the total number. You know, perhaps not more than one per every two blocks of a traditional residential. Perhaps a higher density in the water.
Yeah, that gets into a kind of a situation where how do you identify who gets to do it?
Right.
So, I shy away from quotas or numbers and things like that.
I think all they do is try to make not necessarily barriers, but like Carver City, they all have to have fire suppression. That gets expensive. So,
I mean that's something that we don't have any control over.
Yeah.
I would look at it as a district. You can't, or in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
I think, in the waterfront residential, the multifamily, it's been going on, and, that's been developed that way and working that way for a long couple of years. And to restrict it there, I think you would have probably not a
good agreed there. Agreed.
So, the traditional, I think if you were looking at anywhere, it would be a traditional residential district. And then the goal would be to limit the transition of single family dwelling units over to short-term rentals. So that's the only district where I've considered any kind of regulation.
How long will we wait on finding out about your impacts?
I still have a hard time how you quantify what are those impacts. I'm just kind of thinking through if you did regulate in what way. So I think the fairest way is still permit it, but as like an accessory dwelling. The owner-occupied still have to live on site. Then it gives you that opportunity to have that benefit.
Right.
But you're still not displacing a house.
Right. Correct.
So that, to me, would be the fairest way.
I mean, I don't even see where it is expressly permitted within the ordinance, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing, some communities where the housing is not the issue, but the impacts of the people is where they party and all the trash and cars and all that stuff. So they permit them, but they regulate them by some kind of registration system and payment system to kind of pay for the people that have to look after them, and then it gives someone the contact if there is noise or traffic or parking, someone that you need to hold.
And that's something that we had talked about, was just having a point contact person for vacation rentals, people to have someone to call. At this point, it's just you, or is
right? Yeah, and like I said, I get very few calls about those types of nuisances. Mm-hmm. It's that's not really the
case. It's more of the displacement.
It's displacement is the bigger concern.
I'm surrounded by nine, I don't really ever have an issue with that.
Right, you know, and there's, I can count on one hand how many complaints I've gotten.
One of the recommendations you just mentioned, and out of Traverse City and out of Charlotte, is you have a local number and a local person that will respond for the 911 call that comes in at midnight because they're too noisy.
Right.
Or they're parking in someone's driveway. And instead of calling some investor in Ohio, you have a local person to respond to that neighborhood complaint.
Right. Right. I mean, it's you want to know who your neighbors are. As opposed to a rotating cast of characters. Now, I'd be interested in what is the number of them that are in the waterfront residential district, because I think that's, you know, if somebody is, you would most likely hear complaints from that.
Well, I think most of those are condo associations that have a management company that probably
do. Yeah, like the Atrium, the Harbor, and Cambridge.
Well, no, the multi-family, it makes
but
sense.
Up here on Bay Street and over here, you don't have all that many houses. And, I don't think there's any over here that are being used for that on Lakeside.
Michigan Street, there would be none.
On Michigan, yes, there are.
I mean, obviously, there's got to be some number of them because there's two or three companies here in town that are,
yeah.
I mean, just exponentially expanding their, like, maintaining these houses for people, basically.
Right.
So, was it Northern, I can't think of it.
Northern Michigan States.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That would really wrong. But yeah, I mean, so, yeah. I mean, I have one right next door to me, and my summer this year was exponentially better than last summer. Where I had a number of conflicts with people last summer. I didn't have any conflicts this summer. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, maybe talking to the owner of the property got through and they got a little better communication with their tenants.
Yeah, because I think they understand that, you know, if they don't have a good handle on what's going on there, it may cease to happen.
Right.
Good. I mean, but yeah, we don't have a club, should they really have complaints. We do not have any method of, you know, taking away something if the complaints do occur and they don't do anything about it.
Other than the police handling noise.
Yeah, we agree. Yeah, right. When we got complaints, we respond.
Yeah, okay.
We addressed the complaints. You know, I've issued tickets to the people that, you know, threw trash out and that kind of thing. So
I mean, as far as withdrawing a permit to have a
Well, I think they recognize the fact that regulations can be developed to
regulate
that very quickly.
On a different topic, can you give us an update on property maintenance ordinance?
We're having a meeting with the attorney on Thursday to look at the adoption process and get that in front of the City Commission, hopefully shortly thereafter.
And then on a different topic, Scott and I were at, Scott was working on a countywide bringing in all the people that are involved with learning more about land bank and brownfield. So properties that are delinquent on taxes go to the Charlevoix County Land Bank. Properties that are too difficult to develop because of past situations could qualify in a brownfield, such as Glen Canyon's down here. So the gentleman out of Lansing, the expert, told us he combined the two and used you a tool to develop properties that would not otherwise be developed. And it doesn't have to be a big commercial site. It can be a single family residence.
Basically, any property that's in the land bank qualifies as a brownfield. And what that does is it puts expenses that you can establish a TIF for to pay for. And those expenses include So if there's a property that they can develop a single-family home on, it's on a land bank, and the developer can bring the house in at $150,000, but they can only qualify a person for $120,000, they can TIF that gap and pay that off.
Is that what they do with building trades?
Well, building trades could build those, true, but it's more selling the property and trying to put properties in the hands of folks that would normally not be able to afford them. So.
Yes.
And having a mechanism to pay for that.
Is that the process that's being enacted on the tax delinquent home on Main Street? I believe one of the...
No, that's a property that could be considered, but that's not being done right now.
I was in the understanding it has been obtained by Jane McKenzie's nonprofit.
Yeah,
so
it's not in the land bank.
But it was in delinquent taxes, doesn't that
right.
The definition put it
and
in
she obtained it from them.
Okay.
The city was given right of first refusal and said we didn't want it, and she was able to get it.
Okay.
But the city has a lot at the bottom of the hill on Main Street that's on the riverside, and it needs to be torn down. And we kind of waited to see for this meeting, because now we have a tool that we can give, the city owns it, we can give it to the land bank, and then you have these other types of tools to develop it. It can't be developed now because it's probably too costly, it's too wet, it's a piece of, it's a nice lot.
And that's where, too wet. I think it's critical to do those pro forma to make sure that, is there a gap? And if there is, then you have this tool, because some development could still happen but not having to put in that land bank. This just gives that option that there's no other way to do it.
So the city or the school or any municipality has the opportunity to use these tools to increase housing inventory. That's how this all started.
Yeah, this is one additional.
It's pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
It's one of the biggest barriers, it's just the cost of construction. So you price the house out of what most people can afford.
Yeah. And like
so basically what you're saying is it's a tool to give developers a way to build the house and make it apply for people that wouldn't normally qualify.
And we win as a community because you take a delinquent piece of property or a piece of crap and develop it and get it developed.
Yeah, we're going to long-term
which no other way could it be developed because that numbers just don't work.
Right? Yeah, that's the critical point. It's if it would not otherwise be developed, then you're delaying the tax and revenue for the period that TIF is, as opposed to something that could be developed. And you don't want to implement this tool and give this break to something that was being developed anyway. So I think you need to be judicious in what you put into the land bank.
Are there any action steps that the city commission needs to do on this?
Well, I think right now it's just a learning thing, and then if they decided to move forward with a particular property, then there would be an agreement to put it into the land bank, and then there would probably have to be some kind of reversion that if it doesn't happen, the city gets back, and then some compensation. Okay, what's the city going to get for the property and that kind of stuff? They have to work all that out. And then if there's a third party that you bring into the development of it, like they're talking about the school partnering with them. So the city's got the property, the school's got the labor, so you kind of work together with them. You have the land bank that has this financing ability, so those three could potentially work together for a project.
100% true, but the speaker was saying, and you can start next week.
Yeah.
He was being so proactive and encouraging. This isn't a 10-year study. This can be done tomorrow.
Yeah, all the tools are in place.
And all state laws are there.
Everything's, all the basically boards are in place. So it's just a matter of using them.
Mm-hmm. And motion to adjourn.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Motion and
second.
And Larry seconds. All those in favor?